This is HPR episode 2672 entitled, Porteous. It is hosted by Klaatu and is about 58 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, installing Porteous and the cool things you can do with thumb drive installation.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hacker Public Radio. I'm Klaatu, and I'm the host today. I've been playing around with Porteous, so Porteous version 4.0. It's a cool portable distro based on Slackware. It's designed for USB thumb drives and live CDs. And I started playing around with it after Slacks, which I covered here on Hacker Public Radio back in episode 55, switched its base from Slackware to Debian. Now, I don't have a problem with Debian, but it's not my first choice, and if I'm designing a live bootable environment for myself, then I may as well go with what I want, which is Slackware. I'm a pretty heavy user of these little live distros. Back when I was playing around with Slacks, it became really a daily driver at some points. Whether it was because I was traveling at the time and felt better if I was running off of a live temporary environment, because you can copy your whole OS to just RAM and run off of that, or whether it was just simply because I didn't have a normal computer at the time that I could reliably have, so I preferred to have the OS that I depended on a thumb drive, and that way I could just reboot whatever computer I happened to be around, or whether it was for a job where I needed a rescue environment. Lots of different reasons, but I've been a pretty heavy user of the live thumb drive distro, and up until recently, that has been Slacks. So Porteous is the new Slacks, and I wanted to talk about it here because there are a few little things about using it and installing it that aren't necessarily made obvious on the Porteous website or in their documentation. So first of all, getting Porteous is pretty easy. You go to porteous.org. That's P-O-R-T-E-U-S, porteous.org. Go to the download link. They have two versions. There's the kiosk edition and the desktop edition. You want the desktop edition, unless you are creating some kind of kiosk. You can download the desktop edition in two different varieties, a 32-bit and a 64-bit. At this point, I think it's pretty safe to say that all, with air quotes, all modern computers are 64-bit, so it doesn't seem like there's really that much of a point in getting the 32-bit version of Porteous, right? Well, actually, I've found that not to be quite as true as you might think. Or maybe you don't think, and I'm assuming that you're thinking that. But in my experience, on a day-to-day basis, in normal real life, yeah, every computer I encounter is 64-bit. And we all say that to ourselves because we don't think about it when we're looking at computers. We just assume, yeah, the 64-bit, not a big deal. Well, funny how many 32-bit computers you will run into if you have bravely grabbed your thumb drive with Porteous on it and gone on a road trip thinking, I will just rely on the computers that I find at hotels and things to do my computing on. You'll be amazed. You'll find 32-bit computers all over the place. So or if you're rescuing computers, you know, if you've got it on your keychain just as a rescue drive, someone brings you a computer, and you think, not a problem, this is surely a 64-bit, it's 2018 or whatever year it is when you're listening to this episode, It's got to be 32-bit, or got to be 64-bit. Turns out, yeah, it's 32-bit. So, in other words, every time I have made the assumption that we're well into the 64-bit era of computing, I come across a 32-bit computer. So, just bear that in mind when making your choice. My choice is 32-bit. That's what I download, that's what I install, and it works quite well for me. So you download Porteus, and possibly surprising is the fact that the thing that you download is an ISO. It's an ISO file. And I say that might be somewhat surprising because I think a lot of times, or at least it's my impression, that a lot of times these live distros deliver themselves as a zip file, which you then unzip onto a thumb drive, or something like that. Well, this is an ISO, and there's one official way to install Porteus onto a thumb drive. The official way that Porteus.org declares you should do this is to burn the ISO onto a disk, like a CD or a DVD-ROM, and or CDR or DVD-R, and then boot from that CDR or DVD-R, and then plug in a thumb drive after you've booted. Plug in the thumb drive that you want to install Porteus onto, and use their built-in installer application to install Porteus. So in other words, you need to install Porteus from Porteus. That's a little bit that's maybe over complex for me. I feel like we shouldn't have to use an optical media to install the thing to a thumb drive. That seems a little bit backwards. So I've got two ways to do this that don't involve burning Porteus to a physical disk. Now, one of them is that you can manually copy the files from the ISO. You can mount the ISO as a loop device, copy it to a thumb drive, and then run the little installation script manually that you find after you copy the stuff over. There's a caveat here, and it's an important one, and one that I found after much trial and error. So the caveat is that this won't always work depending on where you're doing this from, because there are, I'm assuming, I haven't actually looked, I diagnosed this from the symptoms rather than actually reading the install script. But I am assuming that there are some commands in there that aren't necessarily in the same place on it, all the distros. So if you do the manual install, you kind of have to do it from either Porteus, which that's a chicken and the egg problem, or you could do it from Slackware, which is what I do just sort of naturally. And in fact, that's how I encountered this problem. It was always working. Every time I would install Porteus on Slackware, it would work like a charm. And then I would do it from my work laptop running Fedora, and it would always fail. And that's how I kind of picked up on the fact that you can't necessarily count that your distribution is going to have the commands that the install script wants to see or expects to see in a certain place. So one more caveat about that, about manually copying. If you read the instructions, this manual copy workaround is a semi-official Porteus thing. I mean, they mention that it's possible. But in their docs, they mention very specifically by name to copy two directories from the loop ISO mount. So if you don't know how to mount an ISO loop, it's just mount dash dash options, I think options plural, or dash O for a short, loop, and then slash dev slash, or rather slash path to your ISO file, your Porteus ISO file, and then slash someplace on your system. So slash MNT slash Porteus, for instance, that provided that directory exists. Or it could be slash Porteus, or it could be any place on your location, on your system. So it tells you very specifically to copy two folders from that mounted ISO to your thumb drive. Turns out times have changed since those docs have been written. And while it sounds like it's telling you very explicitly copy these two folders, it's actually trying to say copy everything, because there's more than just the two folders that it claims are going to be present. So what I did was just an rsync -av /mnt/loop /mnt/thumb drive. So rsyncing it from the ISO to the from the mounted ISO to the mounted thumb drive works. Now, doing it this way also requires, obviously, that you know a little bit about, well, mounting an ISO file and making a partition on a thumb drive and giving it a file system and all those other things. So it's not super hard, but if you're kind of new to Linux, it might not be something that you know off the top of your head, so you might have to do a little bit of research. And I could go through all the commands, but it's all over the place online. It's not a difficult process, but you do have to create, the steps are, you want to have a thumb drive available that is going to be used exclusively for this bootable OS. So in other words, it's going to be erased. So make sure that it's a thumb drive that is clear of data that you care about. You're going to want to make one partition, probably, that encompasses the whole drive. You could play around with other schemas, but that's what I've done. And then on that one partition, you want to create a file system. And I think it probably makes sense to just use the ext4 file system. You could try it with other ones. The only one I can vouch for is ext4. Now, doing all of this from Windows is a completely different story. It is supported on Porteus, but I don't know anything about it because I don't have a system to test it on. Once you've got the destination drive prepared, then you simply mount that, you mount the ISO, and then, as I say, you rsync the files from the ISO to the thumb drive that you've prepared. And then you go into that thumb drive and run the Porteus installer for Linux.com file, which is actually, it's a make self shell script. So it's a compressed archive in a disguised as a shell script. You run that and it copies some further files into some different places and it's bootable. Then you can reboot. And it may take a while. It kind of depends on the size of the thumb drive and the speed of your thumb drive and so on. So that's one way to do it without burning everything to a CD. The other way that I had to do on my Fedora work laptop was to fire up a virtual machine booting off of the Porteus ISO. And then from within the virtual machine, plug in a USB thumb drive, make sure that you have USB redirection turned on, and then install Porteus using the Porteus install. I think it's /opt/porteus-script/pinstall. I think there's a GUI option for it in the applications. And it's a GUI application. You just tell it, that's the thumb drive I want to install everything onto, and you click next, and it does all the stuff for you. But again, the thumb drive needs to be prepared for it, so you need to have made a partition and a file system, and then you plug it in, and do the install really the official way. The only difference there is that instead of burning a CD, you're just kind of doing it in a temporary virtual machine. You don't even have to assign storage space for it. You can just boot it up off of the ISO as a live virtual machine environment, install to a thumb drive, and then you're good to go. Now, the catch there, again, is that you have to have USB redirection activated, which on some virtual machines is easier to institute than others. So I tried to do it with just raw QEMU, and getting the USB redirection to work correctly on that took more than one attempt. So then I just fired up Vert Manager. Vert Manager is an open source virtual machine environment based on QEMU and KVM. It ships It's by Red Hat, as far as I know. So it's, I don't know, I've always associated it with Fedora, but I don't think it actually ships with Fedora. But anyway, it's super easy to find. It's vert-manager. Okay, so that's how to install Porteus. How to boot to Porteus. Booting to anything different than other than your default hard drive is always a process of trial and error. There are lots of articles about it on lots of different Linux sites, so I'm not going to belabor it here. It typically involves pressing some button right after turning your computer on. The place that I worked used to call them snag keys. I don't know if that's the official name, but it makes sense. So you hit some kind of snag key, and it's different on all different models of computers. It's pretty much all the same on Apple Macintosh computers because that's all made by one company. It's the option key, so that's pretty simple. But on other computers, depending on the vendor, and even just kind of depending on the version of the firmware on the motherboard, it could be different. But it usually tells you at the beginning. When you first boot it, you might have to look for this message. If you blink, you could miss it. But usually it'll tell you hit the delete key, or F2, or F12, or F8. It's I'm telling you, it could be practically anything. I've seen it all over the map. But when you press that, you get into your BIOS or your UEFI screen, which is basically you talking straight to the motherboard in your computer. In that menu, or in a series of menus that exist on a little chip on your motherboard, you can set what the boot order or the boot priority is for your computer, such that when you turn it on, it doesn't necessarily look to the hard drive to boot. Maybe it's looking somewhere else. Maybe it looks at the CD first, or maybe it looks at a USB hard drive first. Now you can configure it that way, or there may be an option to not have to configure it permanently, and there might be a boot menu that's available. Sometimes that's, again, it'll tell you if it is available, it'll tell you somewhere, either right after you turn your computer on or somewhere else. It, like within these menus, it'll tell you that there's a boot menu accessible by pressing some other F key, maybe F9 or F2 or whatever. So if you press that, sometimes you'll get some kind of option to change how you know what device you boot from. And then finally, there's the all important caveat about secure boot. It's not always called secure boot. It's a thing that Microsoft implemented on, right? I guess they didn't implement it, but they mandated it onto motherboards, stating that a computer may not be able to boot. A computer will refuse to boot if the OS on the hard drive that it is trying to boot is any different than really what the BIOS expects. So you might have to turn that off, or sometimes you might have to turn the option to ignore that on. I've seen it sort of all over the map, the wording of what exactly you're enabling and disabling. So read carefully. But you probably want that turned off so that you can boot into other things other than the one OS mandated by Microsoft and by the vendor of your computer. And that's, again, not always called secure boot. Sometimes it's called, I don't know, I've seen it called lots of different things, but it boils down to secure boot. It could also, you may, Porteus is EFI enabled, so you shouldn't have to change anything about the way the motherboard sees the devices, the bootable devices. I like to set my motherboards into legacy mode anyway, because I just feel like, or not into legacy mode, but into both, really. It'll scan for both UEFI and what it calls legacy devices. So that brings the greatest amount of flexibility, and that's what I like. But if you're familiar with UEFI, then you might be comfortable just leaving it in UEFI mode if that's what it's in, and then Porteus should be recognized as a EFI bootable device. But those are all things to look out for. As I said, lots of places online talk about that in detail, so that's all I will say. And it's really all I can say, because all the computers are different, so you'll have to kind of explore that for yourself if you haven't yet. It's a good thing to try out, though. So there are different boot modes for Porteus, lots of different boot modes, and then there are boot options that you can append to those boot modes. I'm just going to kind of quickly go over the primary boot modes. The first and default is the graphical boot mode. This is Porteus, I guess, as you would expect it to behave, maybe, or as you would expect a Linux distribution to behave, really. It's a very natural feeling experience. It boots into a graphical desktop. Porteous has, you'll see this when you're downloading Porteous, it has 7 different ones to choose from. Whichever one you choose, once you boot into Porteous, once you've got your desktop up in the graphical mode, you can use it like a normal computer. I'll talk a little bit about some of the details of using Porteous, but in general, it'll just be your normal standard desktop computer. And anything that you, for instance, save to your home directory is, you won't realize it, but it's being saved to some directory called changes. I think it's /mnt/sdx1, x being whatever drive letter it actually is, /porteous/changes, I think. And these files, whatever you've done, wherever you may have made a change, those files are then applied to Porteous the next time you boot. So graphical, in other words, is a persistent mode. Any data that you save to your environment will be there the next time that you boot into a graphical mode. Another option is called Always Fresh, and it does what it sounds like. It boots Porteous as if though it was a fresh install of Porteous, as if though you'd never booted it before. There are some exceptions to that. So when you boot Always Fresh, well, let's say you booted at one point into graphical mode, the persistent mode, and you'd created a file called foo in your home directory, and maybe you'd even installed something to Porteous as a proper install, like you've actually installed an application to Porteous. More on this all in a moment. But if you've done that, then you've made changes to the file system. In Always Fresh mode, those changes will not be present. Foo won't be in your home directory, and whatever you'd installed, let's say it was the Jove text editor, if you'd installed that to Porteous, it won't be there. Now, there's another method of installation. Again, I'll get into this in more detail in a moment, but the other method of installing things is to create modules and then to load those into Porteous. This is a lot like, well, this is exactly the same as what Slacks used to do. Now, those modules will be available. They won't be loaded, but they'll be something that you can access from Always Fresh mode. So in other words, you can boot to an Always Fresh mode of Porteous such that the home directory of the user is completely clean, the root file system is completely clean as if though it's never been booted before, and then load in applications that you know that you need for the upcoming event or whatever, and they'll all be there. It's a really, really useful way of doing things. I used to use this a lot on Slacks. It wasn't called Always Fresh, it was a little bit different, but I would boot into a fresh version of Slacks that had never been, or at least the way that I was booting, it was as if though it had never been booted before, and then I would insert a thumb drive into the computer and load all the modules from that thumb drive into that install, and then the students in a class that was being taught for, you know, a semester or whatever, would come in and use the computers, and no matter what they did, the next time they came in, it was a completely clean, a fresh slate, but again, with all those modules already loaded, so all the applications that they assumed they would have access to were still there, they had access to them. It's just that the data itself, like the OS itself, was never touched. Now, it was a great way to, I mean, all their work was saved to shared drives or to thumb drives or whatever, depending on what kind of work it was, but the OS itself was always a clean slate. It was quite useful. Another way to do it is to load or to choose the copy to RAM option. Now this is a little bit different, I guess, or maybe it's actually the same. I feel like it's a little bit different from Slacks, the way that Slacks used to implement it, but maybe I could be getting confused. With Slacks, there was a lot of data that, or halfway through my time using Slacks, in a very serious way, about halfway through, I switched to having all of my personal data in my life on a thumb drive. It's a 64 gig thumb drive, and that's where I put all my stuff. So halfway through using Slacks, I stopped saving stuff to Slacks anyway, because everything that I was generating was going onto this big pseudo home USB drive. So I sometimes get confused in my mind as to what's a function of Slacks versus what's a function of how I manage my own data. But anyway, copy to RAM is the same as always fresh. So it reads nothing from disk, it does not load modules automatically, and it certainly won't save any of your data that you create. Except with a copy to RAM, as the name suggests, everything's running off of RAM. You can unplug the thumb drive and keep using your computer. It's really handy. That's usually actually what I did on Slacks, just because it is rarely convenient to have a thumb drive sticking out of your computer. Although, having said that, my home drive is always in whatever computer I'm using, so I guess it's not that inconvenient. But yeah, copy to RAM is fresh. Although, you know what, I will say one thing about copy to RAM. Really useful, like if you're at a hotel or something and you're using a public computer and you've rebooted it and you've booted into Slacks or in this case Porteus, the likelihood of you getting up after you're done and walking away forgetting your thumb drive in the computer is very, very likely. So just remove that possibility from happening and just copy everything to RAM, take your thumb drive, do your work, and then walk away. So that's the different booting options. Well, there's also a text mode, so if you don't need the graphical environment, there's a text mode. It's basically the same as graphical, except without the graphics. But in terms of it being a permanent, you know, the data being permanent, that's the same in text mode. Okay, so how to use Porteus? Well, I mean, Porteus is just it's Slackware Linux with whatever desktop you want. So I've got KDE, mostly out of habit because Slackware ships with KDE, but there are others. There's Cinnamon and Mate and XFCE and OpenBox and LXDE and LXQT. So you've got seven to choose from. The size of the ISO is basically the same no matter what desktop. I mean, unless you're really budgeting bits, it's basically the same. It's like it clocks in at around 300 megabytes. Call it 300. It's less in some cases, but call it 300. So if you're used to using a computer or if you're used to using Linux, certainly, then the basic functions of Porteus will be pretty obvious. What may be less obvious is how to install more applications. And there are a couple of different ways to do this. And there's a specific tool that you can use to make it all happen. And it's all new. So here it goes. So the tool used on Porteus to install new stuff is called USM, which is the Unified Slackware Manager? That doesn't make really sense. Unified Software Manager, maybe? I don't know. USM, it stands for something, and there's a graphical version of it or a command line version of it. I tend to default to the command line version. I did launch the GUI version once. I saw that it existed, and I searched for something, and it gave me a result. So, I mean, I think I even installed something with it. So, I mean, it works. It's a really nice thing to have available. But I'm going to just assume that you're okay with using the command USM instead. So the first thing that you have to do with USM is an update. So USM-U or USM space dash U space all to update all of the repositories. USM looks to a couple of different things. It looks to Slackware repositories. There aren't that many out there. There's the Slackware mirror network itself. And then there are some stashes of Slackware packages put up by other people, and they've all kind of agreed on a structure, a Slackware repository structure with certain files there. And so if USM is aware of it, and if it is a Slackware repository, then USM probably has it listed. You could add your own, but there are about, I don't know, six or seven by default. Those are Alien from Alien Bob, Eric Hamliers. There's Slack Only, which is a binary mirror, essentially, of slackbuilds.org. There are a couple. You don't care which ones. There are a couple. And then it also does look at slackbuilds.org, which is just a collection of Slack build scripts that you can leverage to install stuff. So once you've updated all of the repositories, then you can start searching for a package that you might want to install. So for instance, usm-k. K for what? Keyword, actually. It's a keyword search. You can also do a usm-s for some other kind of search. I think package name search or something. But I tend to use -k because it feels a little bit fuzzier. So usm-k foo will give you the results of any package with foo in its name or description or whatever. Now, to install foo, you use the usm, and this is where it gets a little bit tricky. So there's usm-g for get, I think. usm-g foo tells usm that you want it to get the foo package and to convert it to a Porteus package file, or rather a Porteus module. It's not super hard, and usm is pretty capable. So the first thing that'll happen is that usm will find what repositories contain a package called foo. If more than one repository contains a package called foo, it presents to you the different ones where foo is available, and you can choose. You can type in 1, 2, or 3 for whichever, you know, whichever version you want. Once you do that, then USM processes any dependencies required for foo. And I know that sounds very advanced, not very Slackware-like at all. And there's a caveat here. There's a little bit of a thing about this that you need to be aware of. So the USM, so the repositories generally, I think without exception, the repositories for Slackware assume that your Slackware install is a full Slackware install. And that's kind of our way, and by our, I mean the Slackware users out there, that's kind of our way of standardizing on a foundation, on a base system. So when we say that we're going to install or create a Slackware package or a build script, we assume that all dependencies that are already within Slackware, that ship on the Slackware disk, we assume that those dependencies are met. We do not make allowance for the possibility that you have not installed the full Slackware stack, because then you're listing every single requirement. And that seems silly since we're all using Slackware here. Slackware among friends. So we'll just assume that, yes, you have this version of of libc. We'll assume that you have this random library, glib-network. And then we'll just list dependencies that aren't necessarily, or that aren't in Slackware by default, but are required to run foo. So USM does not account for that. I mean, it knows, you know, it knows what is not installed that would be installed on Slackware, but it does not account for those packages. So if you're installing foo, and hey, surprise, it requires glib-networking, which normally is already in Slackware, it's not going to warn you about that. And it will install the thing that you've told it to install quite happily, but when you try to run it, it will not work. So that is something very important to be aware of. You kind of want to maybe possibly, especially if it's a complexer program, you might want to look at what the maintainer of that application says they require. And a really easy way to do that is just to look at what they, you know, in their install instructions, when they say how to install on Linux, they'll tell you, it'll be written for either Ubuntu or Fedora, but it will tell you what packages are required. And from that, you can diagnose what you're missing. You know, if it says when you're running it on Fedora, if you're installing it on Fedora, you need to install glib-networking, then you'll know when you are running the thing and it fails to launch, you can think, oh, you know what? I wonder if glib networking is installed, because it says right there that it should be, and then you can check. So, I mean, that's what I do anyway. There might be better ways to do that. I guess you could do fancy things like ldd/path to executable and see, but sometimes that doesn't tell you everything. I mean, it tells you everything, but it's almost too granular sometimes because it'll tell you exactly what library is not found or whatever. And then you have to find what package contains that. So sometimes it's just easier to look at what the instructions for Ubuntu or Fedora have said that they require and then see if that's installed on your system. Okay, so anyway, USM accounts for dependencies listed by the repositories themselves, and repositories themselves do not account for things that ought to be in Slackware already. Once it processes, so as it checks for dependencies, it checks all repositories for something that will satisfy that dependency, and if there is more than one, then it alerts you, and you can choose which one you want to draw that dependency from. Once it resolves all the dependencies, it pauses and asks you if you would like to install the application. Now, this is really interesting because on Slacks, everything was a module. Now, Porteus lets you decide whether you want to run something as a module or you want to integrate it as a permanent change on your system. There's one drawback from this. If you'll recall, the boot methods that I discussed, graphical is the one that is permanent and treats your system as a permanently evolving system. Always fresh, copy to RAM, those two don't read changes from the disk. So any change that you make in your permanent environment, so if you've installed Jove or Xemax or whatever, and you've just decided, why bother making it a module that I can load and unload? I'll just install it to the system, just like a normal Linux distribution would expect me to do. Well, if you do that, it'll be fine. You can use those programs in graphical. But if you do copy to RAM or you boot always fresh, then those applications will not be on your system, and they won't be available. They just aren't there. If you make the modules, however, they get saved to an external place, an external mount point, and that by default is /mnt/sdx1, or you know where X is whatever drive Porteus itself is, whatever mount point it is at, /Porteus/modules, or /optional. Those are the two default locations for modules that you want to have loaded when you boot Porteus. Strangely, Porteus doesn't actually put, so if you, let's say you say do not install, make it a module instead, and you let USM continue with its process, it'll download those packages, and they all get downloaded as .txz files, or tgz or whatever, but a t?z, because that's what Slackware packages use. And then it gets converted to what is called a .xzm file, which is the module format. The module format is a highly compressed version of the package, and it is placed into a SquashFS is what it is, SquashFS container or format. And then when you activate that module, it integrates itself, it overlays itself onto your system. So an XZM is created from the Slackware package that it's downloaded. There are a couple of different options. You can bundle them together, or you can put them together as a bundle if there are lots of dependencies and you want them for some reason to be sort of placed logically together. You can put them into a subdirectory for whatever reason you think that's more organized. But I usually just have it dump it onto my system. The place that it dumps it onto or into is /tmp/usm. So that's not persistent. That's not going to always be there. I mean, it is sort of, but it's a /tmp, so it's not really. So in order to actually, like, to make the thing a module and to have it available the next time you boot, you want to move those modules or copy them. Copy those modules, because now they're running. Now that you've installed them, or you've created modules out of them, they're running on your system, so you might as well copy them rather than move them, or else you'll lose that functionality. Copy them over to /mnt/sdx1/porteus/either modules or optional. Modules get auto-loaded, or yeah, auto-loaded when you boot Porteus in graphical mode. Optional, they don't get auto-loaded, but they're there. They're there for you. In Always Fresh or Copy to RAM, nothing gets auto-loaded, but they do remain available for you in the slash in the modules directory or the optional directory. So you could activate them yourself. And there are, I keep saying activating, and that's an actual command on Porteus. You can install something like Jove, and I think by default, when you do that on Porteus, it is auto-loaded. So Jove, the command, would be instantly available to you if you had just installed that as a module. But maybe for some reason you don't want that available right now. You can deactivate Jove, or you could activate Jove if you suddenly realize that you need it, or if you've placed it into the optional directory and it's just something that you use every now and again, you can activate the program manually. And that's the activate or the deactivate command. And it's just activate in the path to the module file itself. And that's kind of useful because there are some programs that maybe you don't necessarily need auto-loaded every time you boot Porteus. Maybe you're not going to use that big IDE that you've installed every single time. And especially if you're copying it to RAM, why bother auto-loading that into RAM if you don't necessarily think you're going to use it every time? You could just manually activate it on an as-needed basis. And when you activate a module, it as I said, it's a squash FS, so it overlays itself onto your system. And that's a term that Porteus talks about a lot, is layers, the layers of its file system. And it's an important concept to know because layers overwrite the previous layer. So if you've got a file that you've changed and then you create a layer that happens to include that file, then your change is going to be overwritten by the new layer. It doesn't happen often. It's mostly a system level problem. But it, in theory, it could happen. So that's using USM. It's a pretty simple application. I mean, it's looking at some repositories. It downloads the packages. It runs a little auto converter in the background. And then everything's installed. There are some things that you can do. You can do USM space set space storage, I think it is, and tell it where your module storage should be permanently. And that's a handy one, because if you don't want things to keep being placed into /temp/USM, that might be something that you want. I've kept it at /temp/USM because I'm not sure how great its cleanup process is, and I haven't really explored that much. But it is something to be aware of, that USM, for whatever reason, has, as far as I can tell, no switch to say, yes, make this permanent and copy it to /mnt/sdx1/porteus/modules. So you have to do that part yourself. I think, on one hand, I probably get why they're doing that, and that is because certainly in the past, my Porteus volume has not been the volume to which I actually want modules written. Like, I have in the past kept my modules on a separate device. So Porteus gets booted, and then I load the modules from a thumb drive or some other device manually. And you can do that with a simple activate and then a path to a directory full of modules. It'll cycle through all the modules that it finds. So it's pretty easy to do. So anyway, that's modules and how to manage them, USM, and using your common sense as to where you save them, and knowing about modules versus optional, those two folders. Okay, so that's really everything about USM that I think is important. Another thing, though, to mention here, well, I guess a cautionary note, is that Porteus doesn't necessarily, I shouldn't say Porteus, I think it's more like KDE. KDE doesn't like certain things to be changed. And it's interesting because I've experienced a problem both on Slacks and on Porteous with certain things about KDE that just don't seem to really agree with the live environment. And I haven't tested, I was going to test LXQt for a little while to see how it did, but I had to leave. I'm out of country right now, so I'm traveling. So I needed a good Porteous drive to take with me. I wanted that. So I didn't really have time to mess around. I had to spend my time building up my little Porteous system. But there have been certain things about KDE. For instance, it really doesn't seem to like me changing mostly Plasma-based things. So if I change the kicker, the panel, from the bottom to the top of the screen, which I kind of do out of habit, it breaks KDE to the point that the KDE init just will not function. So when it's trying to start the KDE desktop, it breaks. And that's happened a couple of times, both on Slacks and Porteous. I don't know if it's specifically moving the panels from the top to the, from the bottom to the top. It might also have, you know, because I'm often, I do that and then I add some widgets that I want, you know, like a pager for virtual desktop and a color chooser, because I like to have a color chooser on hand. So there's a couple of different things that I tend to do, and I haven't stopped yet in all these years to figure out exactly what the change is that breaks KDE, but it is something that happens. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you're using the KDE version of Porteous, or maybe other ones too, because I don't know if this is just a KDE problem or if it's sort of a Porteous layering problem or a Slacks and Porteous layering problem, but too many changes to the default environment might be a little bit dangerous. You probably don't want to go too crazy. Now, that being said, there's a lot that you can do. You can install, or rather, you can change startup scripts and set environment variables and drop in your config files. You do all that stuff, and it doesn't seem to matter. The desktop itself, at least in my use case, seems to be a little bit more delicate, though. Now, a couple of things about these modules again, though, really quickly. Modules are super easy to make if you know how to make a Slackware package, which, by the way, are super easy to make. There's a T question mark Z, so whether it's a G, a B, or an X, to XZM script in /opt/Porteous scripts. It's a little conversion script that you can run. I mean, USM uses it on the back end, and you can run it. So if you have a Slack build that you build from source, or if you have a Slackware package that you've been carrying around, you can convert that into a module really, really easily. And that's a really big bonus from Slacks for me, because Slacks had this sort of simplified, it had a Slacks command, and it was kind of a simplified version of Slack builds. And it was quite nice and all, but it required changes. I mean, you know, I couldn't just take a Slackware package and run it on Slacks. I had to basically rewrite the script within the Slacks build system. So for Porteous to just be able to take any Slackware package I throw at it and convert it to XZM, super, super nice. However, what I have found, not related to me doing this, but what I have found is that some modules sometimes cause problems. And for whatever reason, I'm not really sure why, I think it was the Inkscape module. For some reason, it caused all kinds of problems. And I think probably, once again, it's probably down to that whole layering thing where, for whatever reason, a module that you're building is colliding with the default environment of Porteous and making it impossible for Porteous to start some important service. I think it was Inkscape, and I'm thinking it was that because it required, at least that particular build, required Qt 4, and Porteous is using Qt 5, and I have a feeling that those two things collided. Inkscape is a program that I use all the time, though, so I definitely needed it. And I thought, you know, if I'm having this conflict, I could either recompile Inkscape myself, which wouldn't be a problem, and build my own Slack package of Inkscape, and then take that into Porteous do the XZM conversion, and then I'd have my own custom module. Not a problem. Doesn't scare me in the slightest. So I went to Inkscape's website to download the source code, and I noticed that they have a Flatpak available. Flatpak is the hot new universal packaging system for Linux, and I've had really, really good experiences with it so far. So I thought, I wonder if Flatpak would work on Porteus. So I installed Flatpak, and when I first tried to install it, it wouldn't launch. And the reason it wouldn't launch is because there was a dependency that it needed that it assumed you already had, because the build script was written for Slackware, and so it knew that this extra dependency, which was in fact glib-networking, was already installed on Slackware, so USM didn't alert me that that would be necessary. So it failed to launch until I installed glib-networking, and then Flatpak launched. So then I did a Flatpak install of both GIMP and Inkscape. Works like a charm. I reboot into Porteus, and GIMP and Inkscape are both available through Flatpak, and they run phenomenally. No problem. Now, I'm not saying Inkscape will always break Porteus. I'm just saying that it did on this occasion, and instead of making my own module, I decided to test out Flatpak, and I am happy to report that Flatpak is an option. You can use Flatpak. It works beautifully. It launches the applications as you would expect, and you can have all kinds of applications on Porteus through Flatpak and through modules. The other random breakage that I experienced was with Emacs, another program that basically, if it's not on the computer at this point, it's a far less useful device to me. So I really wanted to get Emacs on here, and Emacs just kept not wanting to start, couldn't figure it out. Turns out there was some kind of environment variable not being set somewhere in the chain. I don't know where. I don't know what the fault was. I just diagnosed the issue. So I could have installed Xemacs without a problem, and I was very tempted to do that because I've never used Xemacs, and I know that it was a fork of Emacs, of GNU Emacs, so I felt like it would probably be similar enough, and it might be fun to learn a little bit about the difference. But in the end, I just decided to stick with Emacs because it was what I knew, and as I have said, I'm traveling right now, so I kind of needed to get everything done so that when I left, I would have a working thumb drive on me. And the problem, and I'm just saying this kind of for, I guess, documentation purposes, but also just as an example of some of the things that might happen, there was some environment variable not being set. And it was, I think, window_foreground and window_background. I don't know why those are required or what system really needs them. Well, I kind of do. But they looked, the way that it was being reported looked super familiar to me. And I thought, I think those are variables that normally get set in the .x defaults file. And .x defaults is a file that I'd never have known ever existed if it hadn't been for my usage of the RxVT terminal in order to theme the Rx, well, it's URxVT really, Unicode RxVT, in order to theme that with a black background and green foreground or whatever you want, you have to set the colors in the .x defaults file. That's .X and the word defaults, all one string. Now, I happen to know, because I wanted to change the font size at one point of my RxVT terminal, and I happened to have learned from some random person at the pub at an All Things Open conference that in order to update the xdefaults file, you run xrdd and then the path to your .xdefaults file. You do that, and it kind of does its little processing, whatever it needs to do to update all these variables, and then you're good to go. Well, it turns out that the window_foreground, window_background variables needed to be set, or could be set, rather, in the .xdefaults file. So I tried it. I entered them in there. I set them to some fairly random values, I think. I don't really remember I think it was probably just black and white, respectively. And then I did the XRDB /xdefaults, and it worked fine. Emacs launched. Great. Well, guess what? Next time I rebooted, of course, XRDB hadn't been run, had never been run. So Emacs wouldn't start again. So I realized that this was going to have to be, this XRDB thing was going to have to be something that gets set upon every boot. And I couldn't figure out how best to do that. Well, it turns out upon further research, and this is not what I did, but you can actually add it to /etc/rc.local. That Porteus will respect that change. As long as, again, you don't have something layering over that changes /etc/rc.local. But rc.local by nature is supposed to be user-defined things, so I don't feel like anything would have overwritten it. So that's one way I could have done. But I thought better still, since xdefaults is within the home directory of the guest user, as it is called in Porteus, then really it belongs in the home directory. And there's a directory in KDE5, and possibly just in general, /.local/config/autostart-scripts, something similar to that. I don't know, do a find for autostart. It's there. You can put shell scripts in that directory, and then when your desktop or when your environment loads, it runs those scripts. So I put the XRDB update into that directory, and sure enough, upon a reboot, it was there, it got executed, Emacs launched just fine. So sometimes there are little things here and there that you have to adjust for. It tended to be pretty easy for me. I mean, a lot of these things kind of sound pretty random, but I don't know. The errors were pretty well reported, and it was just things that I recognized, possibly, I'm not sure, but it was, nothing was really a deal breaker, and it didn't take me any more than an afternoon to get all of this stuff done. The final note that I have, I guess, would be about the users and the user and the root identity. So on Slacks, you just ran as root all the time. It was one of those controversial, oh my gosh, you run as root on this distro, how can it even call itself Linux type of thing. It never really bothered me one way or the other. It just kind of was something that I just ignored. But people had problems with it, and Porteus, I guess, maybe had a problem with it, because they don't do that. They do not have people running as root. They instead have you running as a user called guest. Guest. Well, guest is the user, guest is the password. And that's it. That's all you get on Porteus. Meaning that you really can't, I guess, create, I mean, maybe you can, but they note that guest is pretty well hard-coded into Porteus, and that if you try to create a user outside of guest, that you're welcome to try it, but they caution against it. So I have not played around with that option yet. I don't know that I will, because it really just doesn't matter that much to me. I can manage my data regardless of the username. I might try well, both creating a user, but also changing my user ID for guest, because that tends to trip me up a lot more than the username. It's just the user ID. If I could standardize the user ID, that would make some of the external storage stuff a little bit easier. So that's just something for you to be aware of, that the guest user is expected to be your primary, well, really your only user. That's, I think, everything I have to say about Porteus. It's a really cool system. It's a lot of fun to play around with. I'm absolutely loving it, because it provides me Slackware on a keychain. And that's a huge thing for me. It's really, really nice. I have Slackware on my keychain wherever I go. Any computer I use can be turned into a Slackware box for whatever length of time that I use that computer. It's brilliant. Easy and comfortable. You should try it. Porteus. Porteus.org. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.